This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here again with Logo Daedalus, and we'll be discussing themes including current events that kind of relate to this whole theme of America's concept of America having like a Promethean spirit. Logo, it's great having you back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
And I'm also joined here with Matt Peggin.
Yep, good to be here. Nice to talk to you again, Logo.
Let's get it going.
Yeah. This theme of the simulation and, like what we talked about with Baudrillard on our last show. Basically, kind of the theme is, like, what is authentic? I mean, how a lot of thinkers and dissident types, this kind of theme of escaping, trying to escape modernity, or you could say the simulation. Yeah, how a lot of it could be seen as LARPing. In some cases, it might be explicitly LARPing. I think in a lot of cases, like, seeking something that's authentic, that is an escape from nihilism, boredom, despair, and, yeah, just the overall kind of mundane day-to-day life. Logo, can you give our audience just, especially, like, if they haven't listened to our last show, like, a kind of brief introduction to Baudrillard and the concept of the simulation? I mean, original context is he was referring to news, like how we consume news, and how if we're not physically experiencing it, like, is it even real? Like, that's kind of the origin of it.
Yeah, so Baudrillard, his first written essay, the first thing he ever published, was a review of a Marshall McLuhan book. And his general philosophical heritage prior to that was based out of the sort of critical theory that spawned from Alexander Kojève's lectures in like the 30s and 40s and the sort of French philosophical scene that spawned from that. So his concept of the simulation comes from both of these sources, and he's like equal parts like critical theorist and media ecologist. But the premise is really just like examining the culture industry, as other people in the critical theory scene have called it, and the effects of, like, essentially electronic media on, and especially television, on the consciousness of human society in the West, I suppose.
When we talk about trads, I mean, there are people who might actually live that kind of lifestyle, like people who are, like, organic, like, small farmers or people living out in the wilderness.
Kind of like, not to interrupt you, Robert, but kind of probably the closest person that we've had on this show to that would be that guy Scott Tunge you interviewed a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Scott Tunge from South Africa. Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. But the thing is, like, you're primarily talking more about, like, kind of LARPing and posting, like, online memes.
Yeah, but it's also just in general, just the American, like, conservative ethos is this kind of strange paradox of, as everyone says, it's like progressivism driving the speed limit, or it's like yesterday's liberalism. Because, like, this concept, like, everyone has their own little niche concept of what is traditional, and usually it's, like, based in this sort of more regional identity, I would say, and that's, like, the more authentic spirit of it is, like, the American regionalism. But at the same time, it's, like, deployed towards this ostensible nationalist or, like, American identity. But when you boil it down, it's like the American identity, but, like, you know, I'm from this specific part of the South, or like I'm from Texas, or I'm like from the Northwest, or I'm from the Midwest, or I'm from the Northeast, or I'm from like the Tidewater Zone, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all like don't have anything in common. And in fact, like, or like if they do have anything in common, it's the fact that they like all exist within America already. So, and it's like, then it's like, okay, so what doesn't like do, does, is New Orleans like a traditional culture? Like are like African Americans practicing a traditional culture? You know, it's a, like, if all of this like kind of cultural pluralism is what represents America anyway, then how could like this is that, so it's like you're just trying to conserve your particular regional identity.
That's kind of gets to the theme of America as a theme park. Later in the show, I want to get into that in more detail, kind of like the whole history with like the Chicago World's Fair. But the thing is basically what you're describing. Yeah, I mean, either America as a museum or America as a theme park, and kind of how you go to Disneyland and you can be in like Frontierland in the Old West, or you can go to Tomorrowland and be in the future. So I think that's okay, but I think we should just explicitly embrace that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have a problem with embracing that. Like, I was kind of creating the other day. There was like the world's largest theme park at the time in Manhattan, up in the Bronx, that was created in the exact shape of America, and every single like region in like the little microcosm of America, like it's
so sort of like
America.
Epcot, but for America.
Yes, exactly. But it's also literally shaped like a miniature version of America.
Wait, this is a theme park that exists now, or did it?
No,
in the past?
It existed for about like 4 years before it financially crumbled due to like basically not being able to be open. It was like in New York City, so they had to close like seasonally, and this ended up being ultimately like their doom because they couldn't bring in enough money for this. But it was around for like 5 years. And when they demolished it, what it turned into was the largest public housing project.
You tweeted, you can either have the World Fair or a global favela. So the global favela is like the direction that, like, pod living and like living off of Soylent. But you're basically saying, you were joking that either those two alternatives.
Yeah. So my contention is mostly that like you're not going to go back to this sort of actual authentic like pioneer living on the land and like, you know, farming and these sorts of things. Like it's just not really that economically tenable, especially in like the age of like mass production. I guess there are arguments for these sorts of micro farms and like local agriculture and stuff, but like that's generally not coming from the conservative wing. If anything, the people who are most devoted to those sorts of projects are definitely like closer to the progressive side, or like, you know, people you'd consider like hipsters. Like I know a bunch of hipsters who went and started like small agricultural projects like it in like post-industrial areas, like opening up farms for like microgreens in Detroit or whatever, you know, things like that. Or, you know, Lord knows the biggest growth industry is growing marijuana in Colorado mostly.
I mean, that is kind of like the horseshoe theory. Yeah, I mean, both distant left and distant right types like have a strong interest in returning to the land, like small farms, kind of agriculture.
Promoting regional autonomy to a certain
degree. Yeah, regional autonomy. But that is also kind of like the rule of theme parks. Like it is part of the simulation, but it recaptures the kind of aura of how a specific time. I mean, one thing that we talked about, Matt and I did a show actually about Twin Peaks. So, Logo, have you watched? Okay, great. So then we were contrasting the original Twin Peaks from 1990 and the more recent one. And the original one, it's basically a kind of romanticized like theme park vision of what small town America was. And then the newer version of Twin Peaks shows like a more kind of more realistic. So there's a original one, there's a focus on that hotel at the Great Northern, the Mountain Lodge, mm-hmm. and then the kind of old diner, and then some beautiful shots of nature. And then the newer version kind of shows some ugliness, like it will show maybe a trailer park or a car dealership, but it is more realistic. But in kind of like theme parks and resorts, it captures a kind of idealized version of maybe taking from nostalgia or an image of an idealized past. And I think that's a great thing. but I think it's just important to kind of be aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of push back on saying that the original series is this kind of overly nostalgic, the utopian vision, because it's really ultimately about, like, the darkness at the center of this vision, which, like, over time spreads to the point where when you get to, like, the return, it's almost taken over entirely.
Even in that sense, it is like a theme park, because you can be, you could call it kind of Lynchland, so you could be in the kind of small town, and then the Black Lodge, like that. That actually is aesthetically pleasing, and that's like its own other kind of zone of the theme park, so even then.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying there. And then, like, but, like, that's the kind of irony where it's, like, in the 90s, this was sort of a, it was set in, like, the present when it was made in the 90s. But it was still, like, not as much of an optimistic vision of the 90s as a lot of other shows at the time. But then later, it became kind of appropriated by, like, millennials and stuff as this sort of actually nostalgic vision.
It plays off 50s nostalgia, but it's not explicitly set in the 50s. Yeah, I mean, it is borrows from different eras, which also fits in with that theme. You could say of a simulation, yeah. Or live kind of living
you
in a theme
that
park.
You get that in actually a lot of... or pretty much all of David Lynch, well, not all, but most of David Lynch's movies have a sort of timeless, not timeless, but sort of a pan, shall we say, pan 20th century feel to them, where there's, like, elements of the 50s, 60s, 70s kind of joined in with elements of the present time at which the stuff was made. So in Twin Peaks, you have that. There's a 50s element, but it's also 90s, and then even with Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, yeah.
Very modern, but they still have that 50s nostalgia, too.
Kind of an Old West theme, the kind of soundtrack by Angelo Badalamenti. Mulholland Drive kind of has the fifth, like the kind of film noir to mid-century nostalgia, but it also has a kind of... I think it came out in the late 90s or early 2000s.
2001.
Yeah, yeah, 2001. But it does have a little bit of a kind of 80s nostalgia, or like a vaporwave aesthetic. So yeah, with the whole theme of of America, the worship of Prometheus and the industrial scientific progress, billionaires, amusement parks, just the kind of worship of power, aesthetics too, like large structures, bigness, tall buildings, malls.
The invention of the skyscraper. Like massive railroads, and the telegraph was invented, and electricity in general. Like, basically all the things that sort of foreground, or like the radio even, all these things that are these technologies that foreground the transition into, like, I don't know, like hyper-modernity, basically, were all like kind of American inventions, really. And it's where it's like the free canvas to build what could be the world after this happening. And if anything, right, like, we also rebuilt Europe after the world wars in, like, this kind of theme park image of itself also. Like, Europeans also don't get away with this. Like, this is sort of my problem with them, is that they think they still have this, like, authentic touch with, like, their tradition, but it's all stuff that was, like, recreated specifically to basically be a tour. It's like a living museum. Like,
yeah, I've heard
it exists for the Chinese middle class to walk around.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Warsaw, but I heard kind of downtown Warsaw, which was destroyed during the war, is very Disneyland-ified. Just what I've heard. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Well, some of the cities that were destroyed in World War II that they rebuilt, but even places that are authentic, a lot of major European cities do kind of feel like theme parks, and sometimes that's kind of used as a lot of people say people want to be highbrow and they want to avoid the theme park-like areas as the tourists. But I mean that as like a positive way, because you go to a theme park to escape the mundane. A lot of theme parks were also influenced from those kind of more traditional urbanism. So you're talking about the Promethean spirit, like that was, that really defined much of the 20th century. Yeah, I mean, also,
I think,
like,
it's still yeah, the case today. I mean, that's what everyone wants to go work in tech, right? Because everyone knows that, you know, being like the founder of one of the major new industries is basically how you get power in America. Like, look at like Mark Zuckerberg or like Jeff Bezos or even Elon Musk or all these people. These are the people who like really control what the future is going to look like. Like, the politicians and stuff are kind of playing second fiddle to all of that. Because a lot of the cases, they're creating something that doesn't have, it's like totally novel. So there's no legislation to decide what it is. Like, it's the Wild West still, right? And the Wild West is still, or the frontier, these sorts of things, are the very foundation of the American identity. Like, the American identity is this, ever since the late 19th century, with, like, the, and, like, the, up until, like, the Gilded Age and on and on and on, is about this simultaneous, like, nostalgia and futurism at the same time. This sort of, like, archaeo-futurism, which is a term that a lot of the, like, radical traditionalists or the revolutionary right, et cetera, use, or, like, you know, right-wing modernism, et cetera. But these things are, like, they act as if this is somehow counter to the American spirit, but I would say that it is, like, the exact manifestation of the American spirit, this idea of, like, nostalgia and the future, like, existing at the same time. There's a simultaneous future and a simultaneous past.
Yeah, I mean, there is kind of going over kind of the history of, like, the aesthetics. Neoclassicalism, basically, I mean, Washington, D.C. is, like, the best example of that. And, yeah, I mean, neoclassicalism, it's an influence by ancient Greece and Rome. Washington, D.C. does have some attributes of imperial cities that you would see, like, say London or Paris. But when it was constructed, the French architect L'Enfant, he wanted to create something that would be more grandiose, probably closer to those European cities like Paris or London. But Thomas Jefferson actually wanted something more modest, kind of how aesthetics project power about neoclassicalism. And Trump was talking about an executive order that all new government buildings will be in that kind of neoclassical aesthetic. Do you think that neoclassicalism does capture that Promethean aesthetic?
Well, I mean, Stalin definitely thought that the neoclassical aesthetic and, like, this Promethean spirit, that these are all the same, right? If the kind of turn against neoclassicism, ironically, in architecture was a result of the Soviet Union adopting all of these things, right? In the Soviet Union, opera, chess, the ballet, all of these sorts of 19th century forms, the ideal of, like, the 19th century bourgeois forms, were much more, like, upheld, whereas America kind of tried to take over the legacy of the avant-garde. And this was the real, like, culture war, right? So, like, because you had under Stalinism, what was, like, the only legal aesthetic was essentially, like, recreating, like, Balzac novels, like, 19th century social realism, but like, tied to, like, the Promethean industrialism. And but at the same time, you had, so, like, in America, as like, the counter hegemony, it was like, well, no, like, we're going for the absolutely, like, new and the future, like, freedom, like, you can do whatever you want, like, we're not going to be held back by these 19th century standards of what is properly aesthetic, essentially. And that's why, like, that's sort of the irony, right, of these people saying, like, these communists are making these ugly buildings or whatever, and it's like, they would have actually been much more happier, like, they'd be much more content with Stalinist style architecture, because but they're calling modernism, like, these sorts of avant-garde forms of architecture, like, against traditionalism and communist, essentially. But the communists were the ones who were doing all of that, like, created, like, they held on to that.
With Soviet architecture, it was more, by the Khrushchev era, it was more kind of a brutalist, like, concrete boxes. But Stalin had this proposal for these massive, like, numbers of these skyscrapers, think of the Seven Sisters, and they were, like neo-Gothic, and, yeah, I mean, yeah, they definitely do capture that essence of, like, archaic futurism, but they never got constructed.
Yeah, that's one of the fun ironies of all of it, is that, like, the real proletarian culture, the culture for the proles, was developed in America, which was possibly, like, more bourgeois as a society, whereas in the Soviet Union, what was called, like, proletarian art was fundamentally, like, constant reproduction of 19th century, like, bourgeois forms.
How cultural elitism relates to economic elitism. So you could have, like, a system, kind of what we have now. It's kind of culturally prole, but economically elitist, is basically kind of, it is a cliche, but it's based on where America is.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's just one of those fun ironies I like to think of. I just feel like, in general, this is also the problem with, like, the American conservative mind, is that they don't know anything about the history of communism, or, like, how it is actually instantiated, or, like, what the art was underneath it, or, like, who the figures were, or the philosophy behind it. They just call like things that they don't like communism, essentially. And it's like a very inauthentic and like way of dealing with things. It's just like it's total bullshit, to put it frankly.
So in that era of the early 20th century, so yeah, after neoclassicalism, it was Art Deco. Yeah, I mean, Art Deco definitely epitomizes archaeofuturism because it is far more futuristic in contrast to previous aesthetics at the time, but it does combine futurism with nostalgia. It borrows from the ancient. It has the kind of same grandiosity. Yeah, I mean, as a lot of ancient monuments. But would you say that era of Art Deco and industrial romanticism best capture that kind of Promethean spirit? Like, yeah, the 1925 Paris International Expedition of Modern Decorative and Industrial Arts, the kind
like
of
the World's Fair and stuff. Like, yeah, this, like was, the World's this Fair, was yeah. like. It, like the White City and like Chicago, these sorts of things. This was the like primarily like American aesthetic until essentially it was adopted by like the Soviet Union, and they just kept going with it. And so in order to like fight in the culture war, essentially you have like the CIA, literally the CIA funding like all of the avant-garde art. So you have like, you know, Jackson Pollock and these sorts of things being funded directly by the CIA. And because the avant-garde for a time, like there's a switch that happens in about like the 1920s, actually, where you have the avant-garde, the former avant-garde, people like Malevich, like, and Mayakovsky, who were very futurist in their orientation, being eliminated or purged by the Soviet officials in preference for like Gorky and these sorts of people who were... again, like in like the 19th century bourgeois forms.
With like, if you look at architecture, we keep going in these kind of cycles. So there was the Art Deco era, and that peaked in the economic boom. And then the Great Depression was streamlined modern, which is influenced by Deco, but more minimalistic. And then the whole modernism of the mid-century era, which was overall more minimalistic. And then postmodernism, getting to the 80s, there actually is like that's actually a kind of return to archaeofuturism. If you go to Vegas like epitomizes Vegas epitomizes postmodernism, theme park architecture. And then sort of after that era, then it was a return again into the 21st century. Then we went back to sort of like more minimalism. Like, you follow Jack the Perfume Nationalist, yeah. And he's always talking about what he describes as the kind of the kind of neoliberal aesthetic. So like one way to look at it, you go into a lot of these kind of newer upscale shopping malls, and lots of gray and glass, and everything is just kind of in like one rectangular shape.
This is a fun irony. I tried to put this in my book. It's not really a theme anyone really picked up on. But I was very much obsessed with, like, IKEA in my book. Like, really, the idea for the book came to me in an
Which
IKEA.
Which book is this?
Selfie Suicide.
Oh, right.
but this sort of neoliberal aesthetic is fundamentally produced by, like, the Nordic countries, right? So, like, if you're talking about, like, what is the white supremacy aesthetic for today, it is this neoliberal aesthetic. Like, this is all produced by the Nordic countries. This is what, like, this is what Sweden looks like. This is how they build... This is their concept of like architecture, is this kind of minimalist, like very clean surfaces, kind of dull colors, these sorts of things. And then when people are talking about, like, you know, like they're like, oh, like look at these maximalist aesthetics, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, well, that's actually looks closer to like the way Latin American countries build things.
100%. Art Deco did borrow from a lot of ancient non-European civilizations, ancient Egypt, Aztecs, Mayans, etc. But the thing is, but there's also plenty of maximalism throughout European history. Yeah, like French Rococo's from the 18th century, that was peak maximalism. It was like Scandinavian design from the mid-century era, which it was, more minimalistic than the Deco era. Like that kind of mid-century modern design relied upon a lot of rich colors, like in woods, like teak, and in the textiles. But there was this kind of newer minimalism where just, just lots of gray. And yeah, if you do watch like any movie films or documentaries about Sweden, that aesthetic, it exists all over the United States and Europe, but it does, like modern 21st century Sweden is kind of associated heavily with that minimalist aesthetic.
Yeah, well, I wonder, I have to cut in, is there a difference between this kind of Nordic, IKEA minimalist aesthetic and what we might call neoliberal aesthetics in general? Because I think we talked to Jack about this, if we're talking about perfume nationalists. He said, and I would agree with him here, like, he likes IKEA somewhat, but that it shares some features with the kind of neoliberal aesthetic you might see on, say, a tech campus.
I was thinking about that too, but actually my initial thought was that aesthetic was invented in Silicon Valley, because when I think of neoliberal aesthetics of the 2010s, I think of like these newer suburban tech campuses in the Silicon Valley. But yeah, I mean, there's also that kind of Swedish connection.
They emphasize functionality. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I'm kind of writing something about it that I may or may not post at some point. There's what I would consider to be like the aesthetics of kind of deculturation on the one hand, where it's this aesthetic that's as neutral and as functional and as standardized and therefore kind of fit for globalization as possible. And then there's kind of Swedish IKEA aesthetics, and there's something in common there because both of them are minimalistic. But I actually personally, and again, this is not something that almost anyone actually cares about, this distinction, but in my opinion, there is a distinction between one thing, which is a culturally specific aesthetic, in manifested by a lot of IKEA type stuff and a lot of Nordic aesthetics, and then there's a separate category. Although I guess I'm posing the question, how separate are they? A separate category of neoliberal aesthetics, which are basically all about global standardization and the absence of any cultural.
Yeah, and then, I mean, one other thing is, like, there isn't even that genre of aesthetics, what you describe as neoliberalism, as Jack would coin it. It's not even, like, well-defined. Like, there's not, like, an official Wikipedia entry on it.
No, there's not. And that's why I wonder, is it something that when I tried to write about it and when we've tried to talk about it, is it kind of jumping the gun a little bit on really a wholly realized aesthetic, or is it a more political critique of like certain specific structures that have been built, I guess. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I would say like what is the ethic of Silicon Valley though, but the exact same like Nordic ethic of like, you know, the Protestant work ethic, et cetera, et cetera. I was even looking at someone was making some guy who is like advocating for the independence of Northern Italy, I believe, on Twitter, had this map, right, where it's showing like the in the EU or the Eurozone, the net like payers into the EU and the people who get the benefits. And it obviously it matches up with what people generally call like the Hajnal line. And so you have this like where is this like this neoliberal aesthetic really coming from? It's coming from like the Nordic countries. This is what you can imagine Merkel in the like IKEA or in like the new modern McDonald's, and that's exactly that kind of world they're looking for.
Like, would you make the case like almost like a kind of pure like puritanical?
Yeah,
I think it's related.
It's very like. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in where I grew up, you couldn't build anything that wasn't in the like early American kind of puritanical style. Like that, it's just not allowed. Like you're not allowed to build outside of the specific stylistic aesthetic recommendations, because most of New England is also like tourism zone for other parts of it. Like people come up for the fall, they go pick apples, they get pumpkins, they get their fucking pies, you know, and they see like the old, those white towers, the white, church halls, you know, the classic American like Protestant looking church, amongst like the foliage. Like this is like an archetypal image for New England. Mm-hmm. And this isn't really that far removed from, I mean, I was in in a lot of parts of Europe, and especially like the more Germanic parts, or like, you know, the more Nordic parts, this is like their sort of aesthetic, right? Is this sort of very minimalist and like functional thing. Like, it was like, that's sort of what Protestantism is like a revolt against Catholicism for, is for a lot of its maximalism, for a lot of its indulgence, even in like reveling in material plenty and these sorts of things, as opposed to the sort of more somber and contemplative like empty spaces of like a Quaker church hall, which is like a barn, really.
Do you still think that major American cities like New York is the obvious example? Right now, that city's a total mess. But based on when you lived there, like, how did it capture these themes we describe as Promethean? And, like, why did you, like, what originally drew you to New York? And then, well, what, basically, you know, I think you did say, like, at this point, you flat out said on the first show we did that you have no interest ever going back.
Oh, no. I mean, New York to me was always, when I was growing up, like, you know, half of my family is from, like, Manhattan. Like, my mother was born in Manhattan. So I went there a lot when I was younger, and a lot of my family is still there. My grandmother never learned how to drive a car because she was born and raised in Manhattan, and she never needed to. But I would go there, and it's also the sort of place for, it's like the center of, like, a lot of the literary culture in the 20th century. So I obviously kind of romanticized it in my mind of the, as this place. Like, that I had to go, like, this is a very common story. I sound like a fucking basic bitch saying this, but it's very true. And so it, and like, I went there, and it, there's like nice parts and there's bad parts, but it's really just like in this state of decay, really, still today. And there's
Manhattan
nicer,
specifically, or New York in general?
New York in general, I'd say. Yeah. Just like, you know, on the surface level, if you're like walking around the street, it's not as noticeable in some places, not in others. I always like to use Prospect Park as the example. If you walk the perimeter of Prospect Park when you're in like the actual Prospect Park neighborhood, it's like hipster paradise. Everything's very clean, et cetera, et cetera. But then as you move like around to the other sides of the perimeter, like, you know, there's trash everywhere and there's like drum circles. And but the major thing I wanted to say here is that like I always liked the like Art Deco part of it, but that was also because like I was mostly a tourist when I went when I was a kid, right? And I'd go, you know, I'd go like see the Columbia campus or whatever, or like go to the Museum of Natural History and all these sorts of like the places that would be like the origins of like Metropolis in like the Superman mythos, as opposed to like the village and stuff is more like Gotham. And that has its own aesthetic. Like, you know, the West Village is very nice, especially in the winter. It's like, cause it's all like Christmased out and it looks nice. And I mean, that's like the setting of Eyes Wide Shut, which is one of my favorite like Christmas movies in a weird way.
Oh yeah.
No, me too.
Working eventually in a building that was protected. It was like, it was protected like as an architectural monument because it was one of these like great like Art Deco buildings. It was across the street from Grand Central Station, and that was probably like the bet. That was like probably my peak of enjoyment of New York. Was by the time I'd gotten to that, I'd already like worked a bunch of shitty jobs and more in like worse places, and I'd sort of gotten to a point where I was working. I still hated my job, right? But I was working in a place that was very just aesthetically pleasing. And like sometimes on my lunch break, I would just like go walk around like, you know, Grand Central Station. It's a beautiful building. It really is. Like it's very, very nice. There's a lot of very, very nice parts of New York. They're just not the real parts of New York. That's like not where you live unless you're fucking loaded and you have like a penthouse off on Central Park or something.
But you do see that kind of contrast. So with the more like Promethean, like the Prometheus and Atlas statue, which is iconic at Rockefeller Center, which is more kind of like you describe as like Metropolis. And then like Hudson Yards is this new development of skyscrapers, and that would be something, that weird sculpture you wrote about in one of your books.
They built that structure after I wrote the book, which is what
freaked me out. So that's,
it's just like a series of endless staircases going nowhere that people like take. It was like I summoned this somehow. What's it called? There's the Long Park, the High Line. The High Line's really nice.
I also
really like Williamsburg. Like I'm a fucking hipster. Like I enjoyed Williamsburg a lot. It's like really expensive now, but I kind of like hipster neighborhoods, you know? Like I enjoy living there. I like the stuff that they have. I'm like a total fucking hipster. Like I like craft beer bars and like good food. and indie rock bands playing and stuff like that. Like, I'm all about it. Like, I don't understand, like, people not liking it, you know? I that's what I really don't understand. But I guess another part of the neoliberal aesthetic, right, is the rustic industrial aesthetic, right, which is sort of the, like, re-territorialization of, like, the Rust Belt. You have all these people moving into, like, the desiccated parts of cities and revitalizing them. And,
oh, yeah. You know,
and this is all supposed to be very, very
Jack,
bad.
Jack posts, Perfume Nationalist posts of images of how they redo fast food chains from postmodernism, where they used to be kind of like pastel, more pastel colors, and then the kind of industrial chic. Yeah, like kind of like a metal kind of like barn or warehouse kind of thing. Like, it can work if it's done authentically, but I do think, yeah, I think in a lot of, like with fast food joints, it is kind of tacky. I mean, an interesting concept in architecture is when I'm in the big, like, neoliberal renovations, is this place, I'm not sure you heard about it, like this mall, this 80s postmodernist mall, Horton Plaza in San Diego. And when it opened, Ray Bradbury described it as a place to safely get lost. That's basically also, like, the purpose of a theme park.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah, the thing is that, like, I've always loved theme parks, right? Like, I don't really have an animus against them, or even when I see people, like, posting that that very famous, like, Breezeway or whatever, the very famous area that's just all gas stations and fast food
chains.
Oh,
yeah,
like,
the meme, yeah, yeah.
I've been through there, honestly. I've been through there personally many times, and I never was like, oh, my God, this is hideous when I'm driving through it. What I'm thinking is, like, I'm going to stop and get gas like I'm on a fucking road trip. This is nice. I can get all the things that I need here. Or my recent adoration of Buc-ee's, which is the by far the best, like, highway road stop in Texas, where, like, the largest gas stations, the cleanest bathrooms, and you can get,
I think I've heard of that.
It's really good barbecue.
It bills itself as the largest rest stop in the world or something.
Oh, yeah.
It is.
Breezewood, right.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of all these sorts of things, right? And a lot of people, like, I guess Americans will, or, you know, these dissident reactionaries, et cetera, or the Europeans will talk about, like, how America has, like, no culture, or, like, no spirit or whatever, and that these things are sort of disgusting. And I just, like, don't really understand the, like, the kind of the disdain of these things. I really don't, because I like these things. You know, I enjoy them. I don't really have an animus against the fact that, like, you know, they're 7-Elevens or McDonald's places. Like, I do enjoy, like, the sort of regional differences between them also. I like the fact that there's different parts of America that have different things. And when you drive through it, like, you know, different places look different. I mean, I live in Dallas right now, and Dallas is kind of, I think Richard Spencer even uses it. I think he might have grown up in
parts of DFW.
Yeah, yeah.
But he uses that as an example of, like, how there's nothing left to fight to, like, preserve in America or whatever. And it's like, I don't really see the problem with it. A lot of people consider it, like, you know, a lot of other people in Texas consider it this, like, soulless, like, you know, transplant hub or whatever. But I just think it's pretty nice. Like, there's every sort of neighborhood has its sort of own architectural style. You know, if you go to, like, the Mexican areas, it all looks very different. You'll see more, like, things that look, I don't know, or, like, those, like, kind of Pueblo-esque buildings, and then there's, like, there's parts where everything's designed like Italian villas. There's parts where it's all, like, Bavarian architecture. And all of these things are sort of protected as, like, the aesthetics of those various locales. So I basically live inside of a theme park right now.
Yeah. Definitely what you said about Dallas applies to Los Angeles to a
large
extent.
Oh, for sure.
Well,
I just got to go to Los Angeles earlier this year before it was this year, it was earlier this year before the I don't know what time is a fucking mess.
No, I'm there with you, yeah.
but it's very similar. Like a lot of LA looks like a lot of the major Texas cities.
I've heard of Dallas in particular is kind of laid out a little bit like LA, and
I mean, there's obviously
there's plenty of,
I won't dox myself too much, but there's very big similarities between LA and Dallas.
So there's this argument, political analyzing of neoliberal architecture to, like, what it symbolizes, like, what critique that it, the kind of neoliberal minimalism that it conceals power, and it represents, like, a current order of just, like, managing the decline, managerial, like, capitalism. But then there's also this sort of aesthetic that you might describe as celebrity futurism. So, like, Kanye West and Elon Musk and Tesla, Peter Thiel, and the kind of NASA entertainment industrial complex. How would you describe that aesthetic of like celebrity futurism?
Oh man, well, that's kind of like a mixed bag right there, right? Because Kanye's is a little bit like kind of Afrofuturism to a certain degree. Like his
his campaign, he's saying that he wants to create America, to build Wakanda.
Straight up. But like also his housing projects are like these huge like yurt looking structures. They're all like these big like domes, these sort of like circular, they look kind of like, you know, high-tech versions of like of I don't know, like tribal villages basically. And but then like when you look at Elon Musk is really popular with like the kind of Redditor tier people because he's the most obsessed with like the kind of 1950s like Promethean sort of thing, right? Like he sends out like his car that looks like a Mustang into space or whatever, like, you know, that's like, like, it's like a fucking 1950s movie or something.
Or that
like
Tesla.
A muscle car in space.
Yeah, or that it was like a Tesla SUV that was like a 80s cyberpunk vehicle.
Yeah, yeah. He kind of bounces around. I think that's probably Grimes rumming off on him.
Yeah,
80s
maybe.
Stuff. But that's all. I don't know. I just like don't really have an issue with the fact that like America is kind of this hodgepodge of various like regional aesthetics. Like I kind of do agree that the sort of neoliberal like proliferation of the sort of standardized look along the sort of Nordic model is like pernicious. But ironically, that's also like what I would say is probably, if you were to like be like, what is like the people who are actually like low key white supremacist or whatever, like that's like the aesthetic of like the neo upper middle class, like neoliberal management. Right. And that's like if we're talking about like white nationalists or whatever, like the white nationalists are basically Latinos, you know? Like that's the whole Castizo futurism thing is that they actually have much more in common with the like the Latin American immigrants coming in.
Themes that are discussed by those types are things like neo tribalism,
machismo, yeah. Like traditional
Catholicism
gender roles.
Even.
Yeah, they do have more in common with immigrants than they do with like the white upper middle class.
Yeah, that's like one of the just like these sorts of fun ironies I like to look at. Like everything's sort of upside down where like, you know, you look at what's like. Like, that's why it's sort of like the Democrats are the real racist talking point does have some legs, because there is a little bit of truth to it in the sense that, like, in the sense that, like, this idea of, like, absolving yourself of, like, white privilege or whatever, or, like, this whole privilege discourse is in its own way a way of, like, absolving yourself of, like, white privilege. Like, it's saying exactly what it is, right? Like, it's like, oh, we don't have white privilege because we, you know, we post Black Lives Matter or whatever, but the poor racist people who are actually much closer in their sort of values and their like valuing of their own regional autonomy and their own like, you know, localism, these are like the real racists are the people who are actually like closer to the actual value. You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, I 100% do. I mean, there's the people, to speak of the aesthetics in particular,
first been a DSA meeting basically.
Oh yeah. Kanye West is running for president. And yeah, people like to make fun of him because he has like these breakdowns on Twitter. Yeah, I mean, some of his speeches may be a little bit silly. What his core message is I mean, a big theme is God, Christianity, and uniting the nation on a spiritual ground. And he actually has like, you, I think you mentioned this on Twitter, like he is talking about like urban issues, localism, traditional urbanism, kind of more local control. Yeah, basically how the role of towns and cities has to be to address people's needs based on the Maslow's pyramids of needs rather than cities just as an economic unit. So, I do think it could just be a publicity stunt, but I do think, Kanye does have, certainly has issues of substance, like what he said, Rome as the true Silicon Valley of humanity. And he also, I mean, he is supported by, yeah, I mean, he's supported by Elon Musk, but overall, would you say that,
tentatively.
Yeah, would you say Kanye West's campaign captures that Promethean aesthetic? I think Trump's policies have been standard neoliberalism, but I do think Trump's Trump's initial campaign, his like grandiose promises, Trump's aesthetic captures that, but not, I mean, not so much his actual policies. Would you say that Kanye's campaign would capture that?
Huh. That's tough, because I mean, Kanye's campaign is mostly like kind of like a performance art piece, and he's sort of also like going through his own psychodrama, which is like his control over his own family, like within the Kardashian clan, like his kind of anxiety about, like, you know, not really being like the patriarch of the family, because like it's all like the puppet strings are all being held by Kris Jenner or whatever the fuck. But I don't know if he's like super Promethean. I feel like not as much. Like, definitely, I would say it's tough because Trump sort of stands for that in his own personal aesthetic, but the aesthetic of the movement that is being, that has been made around him, is like, it's not really so much that. It's more like the county fair.
Yeah, for sure. That is another kind of irony. So yeah, like what I'll say about Kanye is I don't think he's going to be like serious as a candidate, but I do think it's brilliant and impactful from a cultural standpoint. I mean, in a lot of ways, that's what matters. But I do think with Trump, like, there are these kind of ironies with cultural and economic elitism, because like you had the alt-right who supported Trump, and these were people who were disproportionately economically disadvantaged. But now they're, most of them don't no longer support Trump, but the aesthetic of the vaporwave of Trump Tower, images of Trump from the 80s, those were
kind of very, like Reagan triumphalism.
It was a very Promethean aesthetic. And then you have the donor class, which those are the people who actually do, I mean, they're the economic elite or the right wing of the economic elite, and their aesthetic is basically of like a county fair. So I mean, that's kind of
Yeah, they're like the super evangelical pastors, and Kanye, in a weird way, is like touched with that, like tied to that. But he's a very interesting case, because his like own conception of Christianity is like not the, even like, I'm just imagining like the conversations he has with like the pastors and stuff around him, where they're like trying to get him down to this very standard like American evangelical form of Christianity. He's like, yeah, like nice. And then he goes off and he just says whatever the fuck he wants about like any of it.
I'll confess to being a pretty long-standing Kanye West fan, actually.
Me too, yeah, man. He's one of the best, like, he's like one of the great artists of the time. Like, anyone who doesn't think so is just like, what is your opinion matter?
Yeah, no, I agree. But speaking of Christianity, it's interesting, because there's obviously with Jesus is King and all that, that was what, last year now? There's this big sense of like, wow, Kanye West is really getting more religious. But in fact, he's always been profoundly
His first number one single was Jesus Walks.
Exactly. I do think there's been an evolution of it over time. I mean, I think that probably earlier in his career, he was a bit more standard, the more standard kind of African-American Christian perspective inflected in his music as just one of many parts. And over time, I think he's become a lot more seriously invested in it, and also a lot more heterodox in his views. And there's definitely on issues like abortion, he's become pretty openly conservative about that, which I don't think he always was. Don't really know what I'm trying to say here. Just that with the question of Kanye West's religiosity, it's this evolving, very, I guess you could even say, postmodern thing, where there's different elements to it, some of which have grown to be kind of conservative, but also he's always had a kind of just extremely heterodox pop cultural interpretation of it. If I can just make this one point, there's real creative potential there, and if there's any good thing, and I think there's actually more than one good thing about this new wave of like celebrity politics, it's that these people, and Trump was a part of this too, are in a position where their celebrity affords them the right to actually be imaginative politically, which is something that's totally lacking on the part of any real partisan politics.
Yeah. I mean, that was like sort of why I kind of liked Andrew Yang also. I mean, I still like his general platform. I just think that, you know, he kind of mismanaged his campaign big time. But that's what I was going to say about Kanye is probably the most interesting element of his entire aesthetic that I think is kind of underrated, is his kind of obsession with like Asia, right? Because, like, he grew up partly in China, right? And that's, like, a thing that a lot of people talk about. And he was very influential in bringing a lot of, like Takashi Murakami designs tons of shit for Kanye, like, all the time. Like, they just put out, like, an animated thing that was done by Takashi Murakami. And Takashi Murakami's, like, you know, he was, like, Japanese postmodernism. And, you know, Kanye West is on tracks with, like, Japanese hip-hop records, you know, like, in the late 2000s. And that sort of element of it is kind of underrated.
So Kanye, I mean, the chance of him becoming president is minuscule. Hypothetically, I do think having a celebrity as president would enforce, I mean, it would enforce this idea of America as a theme park. Kanye actually is explicitly, has expressed interest in architecture. And, I mean, that's actually something that I would like to see from politicians.
We all kind of want a, like, celebrity Caesar, right? And, like, people were kind of hoping that that was what Trump would do. But, unfortunately, I don't know what's wrong with him. Or, like, I don't know. I was talking to my parents earlier, and I was like, you know, I thought, like, Trump being, like, you know, a total narcissist would care more about trying to, like, gain universal recognition from Americans by doing, like, sorts of things that would be universally beneficial. He giving us, like, $10,000 checks. Like, what the fuck does he care? That would secure his reelection, right? That would secure his legacy for fucking forever.
No, I can't believe he hasn't issued another set of payments. I mean, it would help,
like,
him.
He's going to do something, like, it's going to be, like, another payroll tax. Like, he could have... Yeah, I mean, he was just given this tremendous opportunity. The fantasy of Trump, like, just carrying out these grand aesthetic visions. Yeah,
the big,
I mean,
beautiful wall, man. Like, what happened?
the appeal of Trump as that he was a builder, not just a kind of managerial type. That he could have been building, like, these grand building projects, but his handling of the economic crisis with the pandemic has been just such a disaster. He's done basically some kind of, like, corporate bailouts and tax cuts, but...
It's like, look at Ivanka, right? Like, that's who's really running the show, is this... And she's, like, the peak, like, neoliberal queen, right? Like, like, what does her house look like? I don't think it looks like Trump Towers. I think it looks a lot more like a modern McDonald's or Starbucks.
Yeah. I mean, with the kind of theme you were talking about with, like, trads and kind of LARPing, you were talking about the Mormon religion.
Yeah.
Archaeo-futurist, obviously in the aesthetics of building these grand temples, like, in the middle of the desert. But
very neoclassical, too.
Yeah, neoclassical. Matt and I went to St. George, Utah. I didn't notice any major temples there, but there was a big... Where I grew up in the west side of L.A., there's, like, a big temple.
Robert, remember in La Jolla?
Oh, yeah,
Mormon temple
I do remember
La Jolla,
that.
San Diego, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those, yeah, kind of Art Deco as well. So this idea of building a new civilization from scratch, it is very American, but it is different than simply being a reactionary.
Well, what I would say is that, like, what the Mormons have been able to do is that most, like, American, like, Christian evangelicism is very sus when it comes to technology, or at least they're, like, suspicious of it as, like, being, like, fundamentally, like, the Antichrist, right? Like, I mean, I don't know how you could, if you're, like, a real Christian, then you think of America as being, like, the Antichrist itself, or, like, you know.
There's a strong Mormon interest in transhumanism.
Absolutely. But it makes total theological sense. And, like, you know, I was looking at, you know, the World's Fair that I was talking about, and the Mormons were a huge presence there. And their whole thing was, like, you know, God is intelligence, right? Like, so, like, yeah. they're very much, they're big in, like, the tech scene and stuff, and the sci-fi literature is dominated by Mormons.
No, I've met a handful of Mormons in my life, and I've always been, really struck by how good they are at assimilating to, like, very modern trends, and just, you know, even just, like, cultural and fashion trends. And they have, like, in most cases, like, a pretty conservative religion, and yet they're very attuned to that
stuff.
Well,
they can, I mean, there are other diasporas that have accomplished this as well, but I think they can, they can thrive in environments like New York and, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, which is not the case with more generic, like, evangelical Christians. would be a fish out of water.
No, completely not. Yeah, yeah. And I'll just say this, as it's kind of an aside, but it's related to what you're saying. I always, for any ear that's willing to hear, I always call myself kind of a sympathizer to Mormons, because they get a bad rap. People make fun of them for their religion being silly or something, but especially in California, in Nevada, but in the West in general, especially the Southwest, just the amount of stuff that they kind of founded out here, like Las Vegas was initially basically a little Mormon. Yeah, still is,
they
exactly.
They own a fuck ton of it.
Yeah, and Los Angeles, obviously pretty much the entire state of Utah. A lot of these places, the Joshua Tree was named by Mormons. A lot of this stuff, they were real pioneers out here.
Yeah, I kind of, like, I have, like, this kind of love-hate relationship with them, because, like, what I love about them mostly is that I can, like, make fun of all their shit and, you know, like, talk about the absurdity of, like, you know, their theology or their lack of theology, fundamentally. But they just take it on the chin and they just, like, really don't care. Like, they're unshakable. Like, and I kind of respect, like, their devotion to just, like, what I consider to be absolute nonsense, mostly. But, like, I feel like this happens with everyone who looks really deeply into Mormonism. Like, you have this sort of morbid fascination, and then it's, like, the more you get into it, you just feel like it's, like, I'm not going to convert or anything. Although, Utah is beautiful enough that if shit really goes down, you know, maybe they should send a convoy and pick me up.
Intellectually, theologically, absolutely no appeal, but like I guess pragmatically they have something, they have a good thing going.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, they're generally nice. Salt Lake City is like a really nice city. I don't know, I they're weird. Their whole thing is kind of this like weird Freemasonic mashup with a bunch of other shit. They're really like, you know, like they're probably more, people talk about the Freemasons and stuff now, but no one's a fucking Freemason anymore. I feel like the Mormons are like the real Freemasons now.
Yeah. Yeah, they have a lot of the most popular rock bands of the past 50. The Killers, Imagine Dragons, like all these main, I don't know, for some reason they're all Mormons.
They have a lot of good indie rock bands too.
They do.
So yeah, as far as like America as a theme park, obviously Disneyland was the most famous, but the very first major theme park was this place in Kansas City called Electric Park. And yeah, I mean, this does kind of tie into the theme of the World Fair, but the idea ties in with, it's aesthetically pleasing, and it ties in with the whole theme of technological progress. Just theme park that was made of, like, incandescent light bulbs.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like, what's interesting. Electricity was just an attraction in and of itself. People would gather just to be around light bulbs, essentially. It was a big attraction.
And what year was
so
that?
If you consider it as like the electrification of the world or of the entire continent or, you know, the country, then, you know, it turns into a theme park.
Yeah, what era was this theme park made?
Like, you know, it's really early on in, like, the invention of electricity. So it's, like, the late 19th century. I don't know the exact year. Maybe, like, 1880s, 1890s.
Yeah, I mean, also kind of like, a precursor to, like, Las Vegas, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you could look at it that way, for sure.
And then one thing, I mean, this also ties back in what we're saying about neoliberal renovations. Like, Matt and I were in Vegas, last fall, and a lot of these, like, casinos have these, like, really kind of extravagant, like, signs of neon or incandescent light bulbs, and then they replace them with stuff that's more, like, LED lighting, or just sometimes it's not even, like, lighting, it's just, like, some of these newer, like, casino signs and, like, hotel signs look like something you'd see in, like, a supermarket.
Yeah, the loss of, like, neon is kind of an American tragedy. Lighting was extremely aesthetic.
There's just something so much more kind of standardized and bland about LED lighting, and I remember that, if you're talking about Vegas, Robert, in particular, I always say that about the Treasure Island sign.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, you would actually say that America was really invented at the Chicago World's Fair.
The modern concept of America.
Yeah,
the America people understand. It's not like people are talking about, like, oh, we need to go back to 17th century pre-revolutionary America. Like, that we need to go back. They're talking about, like, the 50s.
There was also, like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, the Pan Pacific Exposition in San Francisco. The Palace of Fine Arts is still a remnant from that, and, I mean, that's definitely archaeo-futurist. And, I mean, aesthetically, the Chicago World's Fair, what, I mean, it was spectacular, but I think another thing that's interesting about it is it was not built to last. It was basically temporary.
Built to be torn down, yeah.
Yeah, it's built to be torn down, so you build something really spectacular. It's not meant to be this kind of lasting monument that will last 1,000 years. It's basically like a disposable, like it's a movie set. It's basically something disposable, and that, I mean, that's also this theme in American history of building something, then abandoning it, and then just moving on.
Yeah, I feel like that's like, but it's like, you know, it's so odd about, like, you know, when you talk about tradition in America, because it's like the modern country par excellence, and it's like, well, what does tradition mean? Like, do we mean traditional modernism, like traditional liberalism, like they're kind of antitheses, like. If you're like, because like the real trads, right, are the ones who are like, we need to go back to like neo-medievalism and, you know, like way, like before the Enlightenment and like even,
or, yeah,
like,
yeah,
or just, like before the Renaissance, really. If you
like freezing history and time as opposed to like retro archaeo-futurism, retro-futurism is an aesthetic, but it's also a political ideology because it's basically saying that you don't want to go forward, you don't want to go back, that the future we deserve exists on a parallel timeline. But I mean, looking at future trends, and obviously it's difficult to predict the future, so you see, would you say, is it either or, do we continue the kind of Promethean quality, the Promethean spirit existing on a timeline that maybe goes towards embracing the idea of America as a theme park, or more kind of the global favela of like pod living?
I would say like the mainstream like democratic norm sort of thing is like, we just need to create more like affordable public housing, right? We need to just create these kind of soulless buildings, and you know, we just need to like that's like the pod, right? That's like the pod option. That's America as the greatest like housing development project. And in an odd way, yeah, it's still the conservatives who are holding out on the America as a theme park, like the just pure capitalism. Like, what's more capitalism than paying like $10 for fucking French fries or something inside the theme park? And I mean, I don't really care either way. I'm not really too attached to either vision. I just think that this is the real dichotomy that exists. And I think that like kind of like psyoping yourself into believing that the American conservative view is in some way traditionalist or in some way oriented towards a past that isn't just a theme park or like a simulation of the past, but like an authentic tradition, I think is delusional. Like, you can, people are honest about it and they were like, I really just want, you know, to live in a theme park fundamentally. It's like, yeah, you know, fine, cool.
Kind of like you, the idea, like, there's these utopian political movements. They could be trads, they could be, like, nationalist, or they could be communist. But the best way to accomplish that is to become wealthy enough to create these kind of, like, theme park or resorts. In some ways, like, that is what we were talking about with Mormonism, building your own utopia from scratch. If you look at the history of like California and the Western United States, like there are just all these kind of eccentric people who came to California with dreams to kind of build these utopias from scratch.
Even more so, like upstate New York and New England were full of these utopian projects in the 19th century, like the early 19th century. Like Nathaniel Hawthorne was living on like a fucking commune for a while.
Obviously today it is much harder, but just because like costs of land and the kind of structure of like managerial capitalism. But you're saying if that is your kind of objective kind of utopian architecture, like self-contained cities, arcologies. I don't know if you've heard of like Arconsante, that plan for that giant city in the desert in Arizona. And then there's a kind of new urbanism movement, which basically like new urbanism, like that city in Florida, like building cities like modeled after theme parks. Like, so I think for people who are interested in utopianism, they should be thinking more about building cities rather than the political angle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fund, absolutely. I mean, that's like, that's what I was saying. Like, if you actually want to make a difference, like, go seduce Mackenzie Bezza. She's recently divorced and she has billions of dollars. Otherwise, you don't really have a fucking shot in hell of doing anything. Like, you know, you got to become a technocrat. That's the real mode of power. It's not even like the military. People are like, oh, go into the military, ascend the hierarchies. I was saying, oh, yeah, if you want to make a fucking difference, get $1 billion. Like, become a billionaire, you know, get into the whole tech wing, figure out that shit. Because that's who, those are the new Caesars. That's the real force politics. This idea that the police or the military industrial establishment are the people that are going to determine the future is fundamentally delusional, in my opinion. And it all comes out of Silicon Valley, right?
Logo, Daedalus, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, for sure. Have a good one, guys.
You too.